Cool fact, a crocodile can't stick out its tongue. Also, you can get health insurance for a month or just under a year in some states. UnitedHealthcare short-term insurance plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage for you. Learn more at uh1.com.
This is the Syrup Arcade Cast, Mobile Syrup and Syrup Arcade's gaming podcast. I'm your co-host, Dean Daly, and I'm here with the pod's other host, Brad Shankar. How are you doing today?
It's a busy time, but lots of games to catch up on, lots of games to talk about, so I'm excited.
Cool. And we also have, again, I'm always going to say it, Chris Brown, not the singer. But can you sing, Chris?
No. You don't want me at karaoke. Really? Karaoke at best.
Karaoke. I love karaoke and karaoke. So, I'll trick you into it sometime. But how are you doing today, Chris?
I'm good. I'm very excited to be here. A lot of games to talk about. This is my favorite time of every month. So, yeah, let's do it.
I am super excited to start talking about a game that came out in August. We're a little late. August for PC players and September for us Sony players, but we're going to start with Baldur's Gate 3. This is the only game on our list that all three of us have played, and I'm going to just start off with, I haven't finished it yet. I'm in Act 3, but I love it. I've just really enjoyed the game so much. I have one character where I'm like a rogue. Wait, should I explain what Baldur's Gate 3 is first?
It might need a little bit of background. Even though there's a 1 and 2, it's been like 20 years since the old game, so might need a little bit of refresh.
Mr. Brown, you give a little explainer first.
Whoa, where do we start with this? I guess we would probably describe it as Baldur's Gate is a classic CRPG series, so think kind of like old school Fallout or something along those lines. Planescape Torment. If you don't know those games, though, it is a turn-based RPG with a lot of narrative decisions. It's actually based off of Dungeons & Dragons, so it's not just an original role-playing one. This is an officially licensed Dungeons & Dragons game. So if you know how to play 5th edition, you go into this and you know exactly how to play. It's really awesome, and I guess the best thing I could do is probably say to just look it up and check it out yourself. It's taken the internet by storm, and I think we're all enjoying it.
Yeah, it was developed by Larian Studios, I believe, and yep. They're the ones who also did Divinity Original Sin and Divinity Original Sin 2, so if you've played those games, they're also very similar to Baldur's Gate 3. Yeah. Except there's a lot more dice in this game, or die.
Yep. Yeah. Die being singular, dice being plural. I guess that's a big change. So the original Baldur's Gate games, just for a little bit of context here as well, they were made by BioWare back in the day. It was a co-production between BioWare and another company called Black Isle Studios, who unfortunately shut down. But these are some of the games that made BioWare. Before they did Knights of the Old Republic and Mass Effect and all of those, this was the game that really put them on the map. Baldur's Gate and Baldur's Gate 2 especially. And they were based off of Dungeons & Dragons, but they weren't actually turn-based. You would kind of stop the action, and you tell your characters what to do, and then it would play out in front of you. So instead, when Larian took over, they took what they had done on Divinity with the turn-based, and they said, what if we made it more like D&D? Like, you actually had to roll dice every time you do it. And it is probably my favorite mechanic this year, because every time a dice roll comes up, there's so much just, like, pressure that comes on. Like, I don't know, have you guys managed to roll a critical one at a really key moment?
Yeah. Or not me, actually. I don't think I have, but I have seen it done with my friends, like, in the party, who've, like, so many, like, I have one friend, and I'm like, do you have weighted die to where it's only critical ones? Because you roll so many of them. It's so bad.
it's amazing how it happens. Like, so basically, just like in D&D, if you roll a 20 on a 20-sided die, it's considered a critical success, and no matter what happens, you succeed at it. If you roll a critical one, no matter what, you fail. No bonuses, no nothing, you just fail. And so they've managed to weaponize RNG. And it's really, really cool. It creates a lot of tense situations when a lot of other games kind of dialogue can feel like you're just going through the paces here. It feels like there's always really high stakes. So it's cool.
Brad, how far are you in the game? Oh, and Chris has finished it, to be clear to everyone. Brad, you're...
How many hours did that take, Chris?
Hard to say. I'm going to be honest. I have about 4 campaigns going. So, yep. Not sure.
Okay. Yeah, I love the game. I don't think I could do that. That's a little much, especially because there's so many other games right now, but I respect that. I was just clearing up everything. I'm right before like the point of no return in Act 2. So I did all of the Gauntlet of Shar, and I'm at the part where you can go into the, was it Shadowfell? Is that what it's called? And it tells you, oh, you might want to complete things before you go through. So I did. So I've done, I'm doing almost everything pretty much. So I'm kind of meticulous. I think I'm over 40 hours right now, but yeah, I love it. I get it. I totally get it. You know, we were talking about how good Zelda was, and how that was like a front runner for Game of the Year. And now I don't know.
Yeah, it's so good to the fact that it's hard to play other games sometimes because I just want to keep playing Baldur's Gate. Another game we'll talk about later is Starfield, and I haven't even tried to bother play that game yet just because I've been having so much fun with Baldur's Gate.
I was just going to say, when we get into that, I think a lot of people, myself included, Starfield in and of itself, it was just a very underwhelming game, and then I think especially coming after Baldur's Gate 3 just made it look even worse in a lot of ways. Yeah. And I think there was even that like PC gamer story where it's like Baldur's Gate 3 ruined Starfield for me. And I read it and I was nodding my head the entire time reading. Like everything this guy, I might as well just have written this. It's everything I believe. So yeah, that's why I did the opposite where I'm like, I'll play a bit of Starfield just so I can have an informed opinion on it. And I put about 20 hours into it, and we'll talk more about that later, but then I dropped it, and I got it. I want to save BG3 for second, because I know that's going to be the better game, and I'm glad I did. So
let's have a little fun here. What is your character like, Brad?
So I always go kind of goody-goody two-shoe with these sorts of choice-driven games. I can't help it. I just feel bad whenever I do things that are quote-unquote evil. So I kind of thought I would like canonize that by going with like the paladin, like a virtuous sort of knight. I like the idea. I mean, the name just sounds cool. It kind of reminds me of Final Fantasy IV. The main character of that is a paladin as well. Cecil, Chris will appreciate that. So I kind of like that throwback as well. But I just, for me, what I think is really cool about it, and I'm going to write about a piece about this because Chris already did a brilliant review of the game. You should check that out. So I'm going to do something a little different because he actually reviewed it. But I think I'm going to write about how it's the first time that I've really understood playing a role in a game, like in an RPG. Like I've generally, and I've talked about before, I'm generally being more of a Japanese role-playing game guy, which those are preset characters, predetermined characters. I mean, you can customize some of their, you know, stats, but overall, like they're a defined character. The Western RPGs obviously tend to be more so. You can create your own character and do whatever you want with them. And I've always appreciated those. Like, I love Mass Effect. But even, like, in something like Mass Effect, I'm playing Commander Shepard and I'm making choices, but I never really felt like, oh, this is a rigid. I need to do this. I need to do that. This is what my Shepard would do. I just kind of did it at play of the moment, spur of the moment sort of thing. But in BG3, like, I feel like... Partly because the game enforces it, and depending as a paladin, there's like oaths that you can't break, but also just in the decisions that I'm making, like I feel like I'm actually embodying this character that I've created, which is really cool. Like the choices that I'm making, the people that I'm romancing, the gear that I'm equipping, the quests that I do, in a way that I haven't felt that before. And even like little things like you can choose, like I made my character half elf, half human. And then there was dialogue that reflected that, which is really cool because I'm biracial in real life and I don't see that ever represented in media. So it was really cool. Like I was just in the early area in the Grove. There's like someone like playing, like trying to come up with a song for her friend. It was her friend or her partner. I think it was her friend who had died. And you can choose like a bajillion options of what she should compose. And then I just had this dialogue with her about, why don't you write a song about being mixed? And I'm like, that's so cool. Like that, I've never seen that in the game before. And like, that's me. And it's like kind of reflecting my life experience. And when I saw that, that kind of clicked for me. Like, oh, okay. I'm literally like embodying this role. This is my character. I in a way that I haven't felt in an RPG before, which I thought was really cool.
In one of my playthroughs, I kill her. The animals are like, the noise is so bad, stop it. And I was like, I'll stop it for you guys, animals. So then I kill her. because you can talk to animals, which is also really great. I love the game. My character, I have multiple characters because I'm in multiple playthroughs as well. But my main playthrough, or the one I'm furthest in, I'm a rogue and I'm in the shadows, stealthy and stuff. I'm a drow, which means a dark elf. But I also am a bard. I started as like an arcane trickster, but you can reclass, and you can reclass very easily in this game, which I love. I love that it gives you the opportunity to try out new things. And then a part of my RP, though, was I went to my friends and I said, hey, guys, I'm coming out of my shell. I've been playing music quietly on the side, and now I'm going to take it to the streets and become a bard. So now I became a rogue bard-like character who's playing music and doing all these cool things. Random thing. I love that I could just play music and people throw money at you. It's just like, you're like, you just pick up the change off the ground and you're like, that's a trophy. That's so you get in 100 coins of the trophy. And I'm like, this is really random. Not something I thought that this game would have, but I love it. Chris, tell us about one of your characters.
So similarly, in my solo playthrough, which is the one that I've completed, is I played a warlock who was a drow as well. And much like you guys, it was really interesting seeing how every decision that you made when you're making your character played out. Because when you play a drow, you know, being somebody who comes from a race that was seen as evil in the world of Dungeons and Dragons. In Faerun, Lolth Drow, for example, have basically been raised to despise other races. And so they're seen as very violent and all these things. Whereas the other Drow, who also were raised in the Underdark, basically want to make amends and are looking to create peace with other races and species. And so playing a drow in this game comes with a lot of consequences that, Dean, I'm sure you've seen as well. Like, a lot of people outright hate you when they first meet you. And you kind of have to overcome those barriers. And for me, that's playing a role that I don't really face in real life, as I'm not a visible minority, right? And so putting myself into that was a really, really interesting kind of exercise, and I love the game for that, because in my other playthroughs I'm playing a dragonborn and that comes with other things, and in another one I'm playing just an elf and they don't really face any of the prejudice that the other two do. But to get back to it, basically in my main playthrough I was playing a warlock drow. In my other, with my friends, I'm playing a half elf rogue as well. And Dean, a similar journey where I was like, what if I tried to learn music, because we have a bard in our party, but I'm really bad at it. And so I just have an instrument, but I don't know how to play it. If I play it during combat, everybody just tries to attack me. And so it's a great way to be a distraction. And like, lore wise, I'm like, well, my character doesn't know how to play, but really wants to be a rock star. So it gives you so many opportunities in every little moment to find your character. It's like not even in dialogue. It's like the way you approach situations. As a rogue, of course, you're going to be sneaking and stealthy, and you can pickpocket people. The amount of times I've been thrown in prison, my goodness. But I know how to get out of prison really, really well. And my party members are cool to play along with that. Like, it's such a good multiplayer game because it allows you to approach situations however you see fit. And then when you're playing solo, it's kind of the payoff. Years ago, Ken Levine, when he finished up Bioshock Infinite and he started his new studio, he talked about how he wanted to create a game that used narrative Lego. Essentially, he wanted something that you could have building blocks and everything would connect in a different way based on how you approached a situation. And I've never seen that pay off before until now. Baldur's Gate is the first time where no matter what I try to do, no matter who you kill, no matter who you save, no matter how you approach a situation and seem to screw it up, the game will adapt to you. It's incredible. So I highly suggest anybody who is checking the game out, even if you don't finish the game, and if you know, even if you don't have time, I suggest starting a new playthrough with a new character just to even see the opening few hours and how different they are, because that carries through the entire experience.
Well, and to your point, I think the game is good in for many reasons, but in that, and we'll get into it later, unlike something like Starfield, which just feels big for the sake of being big, everything feels purposeful in Baldur's Gate. Like, you can mainline the story if you wanted to and probably do it in a lot shorter, but all that side content is purposeful. You get what you get as much out of it as you want, really. How much the quests you pursue, the people that you recruit, the all of that stuff. Like, it's not like, what I like about it is it's not like, like Act One really is just one somewhat large map, and then there's a few other like side areas, but so it's not really that large by any kind of metric, but it's dense, and that's what I like about it. And same thing, like Act Two is pretty much entirely in like the Shadowlands, and again, there's a few other areas, but I like that it's dense. You can be like, one thing that was cool for me, like in Act One, when I was clearing up everything before I moved on to the point of no return, there was an area. I went back to the goblin camp, I forget for whatever reason, but there was an area like in the corner of the map that hadn't been filled out yet. It was a small area, but I'm like, oh, I haven't checked that out. Let me go see. And then it led to the entire swampland area. And I'm like, oh, cool. There's like a Hansel and Gretel sort of old witch here.
Yeah,
and there's a whole story there. And then after that, because I did that first, I went into like the marshland nearby where there's all these like zombies and everything, and I found some dead bodies, and I'm like, I forgot you could do speak to the dead. So I'm like, I want to try that. And I spoke to the bodies, and it was the family of the woman, of the girl that the witch had kidnapped, who had died trying to find her. And I'm like, that cool little like environmental storytelling that you could completely miss out on if you just walked out. It's not like, but I love that sort of thing. And that was entirely just because, oh, this is a part of the map that I hadn't looked at. Again, it's not a huge open world map for the sake of it, but there's purposeful discoveries like that. Something as big as that, or something even as small as, oh, here's a little shrine, or here's a little whatever, and they're all varied, which I love.
You know what's funny about that, Brad? If you went in from the other angle, you see the two brothers try to talk to Gretel, and she's like this old little lady, and she's like, and you're like, man, stop picking on the lady. So I killed them.
Oh no,
I killed the two brothers, and because they're like picking on this little lady, and the lady invites you back to her house later, and then you go to her house and you see what started happening, you're like, wait, no, I don't think I trust this. There's also a you speak with animals, and you see there's little sheep around, you speak to the sheep, and they're like, they say something like ba, or what was it, it was like, oh, they say something, and they're like ba. Like, because they're not actually sheep. It was, they're part of the witch's cool stuff, right? Yeah. And you're like, it looks like this beautiful little area. And then you speak to her and find out she's a witch. And it all turns to this gross swamp. And you're just like,
this
is like really cool. It's, you just come in, and I've done the other way where I came in and saw them dead. You see these like different like ways to play this game. Oh, yeah. And
I didn't even know that.
If you go through her house, eventually there's a way to get into the Underdark.
Yeah.
So you're like, what? There's so much depth in that, this one game, this one little area. But there's so many options you can do as well. I love it.
Even the fact that you can speak to animals and the dead, like that is just something that I've been playing all kinds of RPGs since I was a kid. And even like in the small ones, like Pokemon, you know, you go into characters' houses and you talk to all the NPCs or whatever. That's just something that's kind of routinely ingrained in me. But this is the one game where it's like every animal and every corpse I can try to talk to. And almost all the time they have something interesting to say, even if it's just a fun interaction or it reveals more of the world or part, it feeds into a quest. And I'm like, that just completely changes. Even that one thing changes how I approach like exploration and going through towns and going through areas or whatever. Cause it's like, these are, any other game I would just loot a corpse and move on, or any other game I'd see a squirrel running by and it's like, oh, it's just a squirrel. It's, you know, it's just set dressing. But this game, even little things like that, they matter, which is cool.
Well, and that's what I was kind of going to build on, because this game is the first one that I can think of where I forget what the main quests are.
And so many times.
Yes.
And it, even when we're talking about Auntie Ethel, who's the kind of witch that we're talking about, they do a really good job of building it up so that when you eventually get to the swamp, you do realize and get this unsettling feeling. Totally. But you actually first meet her when you are in the tiefling camp. Like, she's just somebody who's selling potions and that.
Well, I didn't even know she was there.
Yeah,
she's there. My friend told me that. Yeah.
You already have this established relationship where she sells you something and she seems like a perfectly sweet woman. Then you run into her on the road if you take that path. And of course you're going to side with her. We've already met her. We trust her. We have this. So depending on how you approach the situation. And then again, depending on the outcome of whether you fight her, you help her, you kill her if you fight her, or you save her if you fight her, there are different rewards and outcomes that can lead to entire paths that will go into Act 3. So the amount of detail that they had to pay to every branching path, you know, I've studied a little bit of nonlinear storytelling, and essentially you're looking at like a chart of, okay, point A, B, C, this is going to be the story. And then you have branching. The more dialogue choices you give, the more of those, the scope of the game just expands and expands and expands. I can't even imagine how they built the storytelling in this to make sense with all of the choices. Because you're right, you can talk to every animal, you can talk to every corpse. They are not just set dressing. There's no small characters in the game. None of the dialogue that I've heard, I've gone, okay. You know, it's like there's no repeated lines over and over and over. Like, I love Xenoblade to death, but my goodness, you hear some lines 50 times over the course of an hour, and there's none of that. They all feel like people who actually inhabit the world.
No, I love the little things in it, too. I was walking along a path, and we saw this blue jay. He looked a little disturbed, so we talked to the blue jay, and you find out that there's some eagles in his nest, right? So you're like, okay, let's go help out this blue jay from these eagles. So we go up to the eagles. They're above like the Githyanki area, and you go to these eagles and you talk to the eagles, and they're just there to protect their babies, but we need something in the nest. So we're like, you know what, let's turn on non-lethal combat, let's just knock out these eagles, forget about the blue jay, screw the blue jay, let's just grab what we need to grab. Like, they're just trying to live their life with their babies. This blue jay is a solo blue jay just chilling, so let's just do that, let's knock them out. Right? So we knock them out. When you knock out a character, they are left with about 1 or 2 health. Like, super low, but they're sleeping. In the next few seconds, the blue jay comes and kills the eagles and says, "Thanks, man. Thanks for clearing this area for you." And we're like, "No! Why did you kill them?" We're like, "Why did you do that? You can't trust anyone." But I just love that they thought of that. I love that, like, we didn't have to go back to the blue jay and be like, "Oh, like, the nest is free." It knows that the eagles are gone. Like, the game, that path was like to tell it to go. And it's just insane what you can do in this game. I told Chris my romance option, and I won't say it for Brad. I don't want to spoil it. But I told Chris who I romanced, and Chris was like, "What? I didn't know you can romance that person."
I didn't know you could romance this part. Like, okay, here's the thing. You can. Most people know you can romance most of your party members. You kind of continue to build the party over the course of the game. There are a few other characters you can bring in that aren't romanceable, but you can romance most of your party members. I knew that there was a couple outside of the party that you could romance. I had no idea about this one. That was wild. Why you would want to, also pretty wild. So, questionable at best.
I can't wait for you to, Brad, you meet this character kind of at the beginning of Act 3, I want to say, or the end of Act 2. So you're going to get them really soon.
Yeah.
But it is hilarious. But
There's a few other games that I'm gonna have to put a pause on this because of the game, because there's a few other things that I have to get to. But I'm pretty much at the end of Act 2. I will say there are some things that I wish, I mean, again, a game this branching and this expansive, there's gonna be some kind of issues. But I do think there's some times where it feels like the game is saying one thing and that's not always what happens. Like, you were mentioning the you went non-lethal for the Blue Jays. Like, when I was doing the anti-ethal quest, she has a bunch of like people who are like possessed by masks, and the game like literally told me, "This is how you do non-lethal." I'm like, "Oh, okay. So if I knock them out, maybe after I kill her, or even if I talk to their body that I've knocked out, I can remove the mask or whatever, but and then save them." But nothing happened there. I'm like, "Okay, it's kind of weird." Or like in the Shadowlands, the when you get like one of the lanterns to navigate it, it's the narrator's like, "Oh, pixies can't be trusted. They're either mischievous or evil." basically. And I'm like, okay, so I'm just going to leave her in here, especially after I said that the pixie's like, I'm going to kill you. You're a horrible. Like it basically went a complete 180 on you. And then I broke my oath because of that. And I'm like, what? I'm like, I didn't kill anyone. I didn't think that would break my oath. I'm like, that felt a little cheap to me in that sense. But I mean, those are minor things. Obviously, there's so many things you can do in this game that I can't expect everything to play out exactly as I would have imagined.
Which oath did you pick?
I forget which one.
Okay, I can only think of Vengeance. I can't remember the other.
Because to me, I thought mine was like, thou shalt not kill sort of thing. It's like the oath, whatever it's called. But it's like, if this thing's already trapped in here and is basically threatening to kill me, I didn't think leaving it in there would be bad.
Right. So,
like, some things make sense. Like, oh, I shoved... one time I'm like, oh, maybe to get a head start on a fight, I'll just try to shove this guy off the cliff. But because I didn't provoke the fight, I killed him in cold blood. From the perspective of the game, I'm like, that makes sense. I get that. I'll own that. I'll, you know, I did restart my save, but I'm like, I get that at least. But yeah, overall, I do just like, I actually kind of like having that oath because it does sort of hold me accountable and keep me on that path of, and then there's obviously benefits and pros and cons to sort of keeping it and maybe becoming an oath breaker or whatever, which is cool.
My group, our main thing is we do not support slavery. And there's a lot of slavery in this game, surprisingly enough. So we do not.
It's a good rule of thumb.
Yeah. So I mean, like my other campaign, my character is like a rich bastard. He doesn't really care about slavery or not. He's rich. Our one campaign, we're like we do not support slavery. If there's a slave master, we'll kill him always. So we let the pixie out because technically we'd be enslaving the pixie. And then it gives you like a bonus and it's super nice and it goes away. And I was just like, thank you, Pixie. This is dope. Whereas like you and Bennett also kept the Pixie in the lamp. So like they're like, because it tells you like the game kind of does say like it is mischievous, but if you just try different things, I mean, there's a lot of weird things happen. There's three bosses in that town that you come into afterwards. And you don't have to fight them all to kill them.
No. Well, first of all, that town was super cool. It reminded me of Bloodborne, especially the medical clinic and like one of the weapons that the doctor uses, even like the buzzsaw thing from Bloodborne. It looks like just like it. So I was getting real Bloodborne vibes from there. But yeah, I love like even as an example, Thorm, I think his name was the big bartender dude.
Yeah, yeah.
Like I love that you could just. You can kill him by out drinking him, which is amazing. And again, to the point of your choices actually mattering in both big and small ways. Like the stories you can tell him are all the side quests you've done. So like I did every side quest pretty much. So my list was like super long. I'm like, oh cool, I can just mention any of these. He wasn't really interested in them, unfortunately. But I just like that, like little things like that, like showing that the impact, like recognizing your choices. It actually feels like it matters. Like. I love that sort of thing.
Yeah, all three of those characters, I don't think I fought in one playthrough. I don't think I fought any of them, but I killed them all. Like they just you can get them to kill themselves, and it's just really cool and thoughtful. Or you can have these really hard battles if you want them, if you want to as well. But I just love the choice there. I love the like the different options and what this game has. There's so much you can do and things that you can never think of trying or like, and then I mostly just play in my campaigns. I in my solo run I haven't gotten that far. I don't actually have as much fun playing it by myself, but playing it with my friends will say something and I'm like, that sounds kind of dumb, but all right, I'm gonna let them try it, and then it turns out good and it's you get a trophy or something, and it's fun. I love that. That is what happened. Like that's how I knew that you didn't have to kill those guys, because one of my friends spoke to it, the money one.
Yeah, the gold. Yeah,
yeah, and it just blew itself up, and it was just like, okay, cool. I don't. Why did that happen? And why did you think that would happen? Like for me, I was ready to start attacking it. Like I was sneaking up on it, and my friend's like, no, let me talk to it first. I was like, all right.
Well, and for full context, I'll just say, because I actually haven't played the game with anyone else. I've only played it solo. So I, obviously, that's what I think is so cool about it. The fact that you can play it entirely solo, entirely with friends, and the experience is great both ways. Obviously, you get something different if you play with someone else, but I think that's super cool.
And you know, I think both play very differently. They're almost like two different games, because when you're playing solo, a lot of the focus is on your party members and growing those relationships, seeing those arcs. When I've played both the one campaign, I'm playing with my dad, and so it's just the two of us, so we bring party members along. And another one, I'm playing with friends, and so with them, we don't even pay attention to the party members. It's too much to focus on for all of us to go through all the dialogue. Only one of you can really, you know, focus on a party member, and if you don't bring them with you, they're not going to have as strong of feelings about situations and all of that. So it's really a different experience on how you play it. But I also just think that it encourages creativity in such a refreshing way. The way that things pay off is always, or not always, almost always satisfying to how you initiated it. So if you choose combat and you go the violent approach, you have creativity in the way that you actually go through that, using your abilities and all of your items. If you choose to talk your way through it, depending on how you talk your way through it, that could pay off. If you choose to avoid it entirely and use environmental stuff, that will pay off. And I find that in a lot of games, I choose to not be overly creative because I'm more interested in the story. And, you know, creativity is such a part, a large part of what we do day to day in our writing and so much of that, that I'm really looking for that escape. Whereas a game like this, the story is the creativity. And so that's why I always want to see every outcome and try to do things that no one else has thought of. And that's such a rare thing. So I really, really appreciate it with this game.
So I think we should move on to the next game on the list. The game that came out the same day as Baldur's Gate 3 for PlayStation players, Starfield. I have not touched Starfield because I've been playing Baldur's Gate, and then I've moved on to Lords of the Fallen and Lies of P. So, you two, how is it? It doesn't sound like you like it a lot, Brad. And Chris, are you of the same mind?
I am most likely on the same page as Brad. I don't know to what degree, but I know we've talked about this a little bit in the past. I've never connected with Bethesda games at the same level that a lot of people have. Skyrim maybe being the exception, where I found a playstyle that I really, really liked. And so I ended up not even really doing any story stuff, just kind of doing thieving throughout the world. I became a thief who just stole every item and hoarded gold. But outside of that, I've never really connected with their games. But I'm also more of a sci-fi guy than I'm a fantasy guy, so I thought this might be the one. Didn't really turn out that way. Maybe I'll let Brad, you kind of dig in first and I can chime in.
Yeah, for me, it just, everything about it just feels sterile and superficial. Like it's offering the illusion of freedom, the illusion of this is a grand story that you're on and you're doing all these kinds of things, but all of it just feels undercooked. Like from the exploration, which is literally just you navigating menus and selecting hovering over a JPEG and then selecting a landing point, to when you actually land on said planet and it's completely empty. And then the game literally has a mechanic where you can build outposts like Fallout 4. So the game basically wants you to make this empty planet less empty. There's no vehicles to traverse this long space on these empty planets. So you're literally running. No. So you're literally running like 1500 in-game meters, which is a lot, from one generic sci-fi facility to another generic sci-fi facility, with pretty much the same copy and paste stuff in between. The allies that you have are all automatons. I've seen that word thrown around a lot, and I agree with it, especially compared to Baldur's Gate 3. I've had one conversation with Astarion has more personality and charm than anybody I've met in 20 hours of Starfield.
Like, very much so.
The characters are just dull. I couldn't tell you anything about any of them. I only remember Sarah Morgan because she's like the first one you meet. I find the shooting is very serviceable at best. Like, and the funny thing is, there is a thing with that, with the game, like you can unlock powers, but they hide that from you. And because of the way the game's structured, it's through the main quest. So if you just go off and do the side content, which a lot of players are going to do, you're going to miss unlocking these powers. What they should have done is like a Tears of the Kingdom sort of thing, where you're railroaded into the first few hours of everyone has to do the same thing, and you unlock all the main abilities. So then that way, when you go off to explore, everyone has the same toolkit, right? So what you do with that toolkit is up to you. That's what's cool about Tears of the Kingdom. It's go on, you'll have fun. But in this game, yeah, like I completely missed that. So the combat for me was just pew, 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 the most generic guns. And I'm like, this is supposed to be what, like hundreds of years in the future? And there's like, it's just generic rifles and shotguns and everything. And people are like, oh, this is Bethesda's best combat. Yeah, and I'm like, well, that's not saying much. You know, like maybe if it was like a Mass Effect 1 to Mass Effect 3 style, where Mass Effect 3 was literally like Gears of War level of shooting versus the first game. But like this game, I'm like, OK, it's a little better than Fallout, but Fallout was never that good for shooting. And Fallout at least had the VAT system to kind of make it a little different. And Skyrim had magic, of course, and like bows and arrows and everything. So, yeah, to me, it's the epitome of a game that's big for the sake of being big, but there's nothing compelling to do in it. Again, compared to something like BG3, which has a lot of content. You could spend just as much, if not longer, playing one playthrough of BG3, but everything is varied. Everything feels purposeful. Everything is dense. Everything feels handcrafted. It's not just here's a bunch of planets that are palette swaps of the same thing. Like, yeah, I respect that, you know, they got to make the game they wanted, seemingly. You know, I know it seems, at least in my experience, it was fairly polished, which is something kind of faint praise for, but it's something for Bethesda, especially given how big the game is. And I've seen people who are having a good time with it, and I'm happy for them. I after 20 hours, I'm like, I'm really not enjoying this. There's no sense of wonder or mystery, or the world is so boring to me. Like, there's nothing interesting about the lore. Like, finding out the reason, like, why Earth was abandoned and all that. Like, I read up on that after the fact. I'm like, oh, okay, that's kind of dull. I'm like Mass Effect in 5 minutes had a more interesting sci-fi world than Starfield did in 20. Yeah, I'm like, I especially because this year is such a good year for games. I'm like, this. If it is up for game of the year with it, and I think it might be just because they're of a bit of a probably Bethesda bias from some people, but I don't think it deserves to even be in the top 10 of the year personally.
Dang, that is saying something from a Bethesda game. That is crazy. I wasn't expecting that.
Yeah. And I come from a similar place as Chris, where I don't have a lineage with these games generally, but I did really enjoy Skyrim. I played a lot of it. I got really into that in high school and I did like the game, but even then, like, that's a game where in any other Bethesda game prior to this, you could start from point A and realistically run all the way to the other end of the map. And that's the sort of exploration. And that's cool. Like, I have fond memories of going through Skyrim and, oh, here's this academy and like the snowy mm-hmm. mountains. And there's this whole like story to that. I'm like, that's cool. And if such a thing was in Starfield, there would be 500 menus in between that. Even the main quest lines, the first five of them are like fetch quests. It's like, go to this planet, go to this planet, go to this planet, go to this planet, just to like, and ultimately talk to one person. And I'm like, this is like 2005 game design, guys. Like,
oh, dang.
The mission design, like, even if you yeah. can't avoid all the loading screens and everything, because I get it, there's technical limitations with that. It's like, even the story design, the quest design, and even just, I don't feel like I'm really having an impact on things. Like, the choices that I'm making just feel pretty superficial. Like, even like I did one of the last side quests I did was joining this, like, I think a biotech company or whatever. And then the person wants you to go get coffee for her because you're like bottom of the totem pole. So I go to get the coffee, and then some ex-employee shows up to me. And unlike BG3, which at least has kind of a fun randomized ish, like RNG sort of thing with the die, like, I talked to this guy, and because I didn't say the right thing, he just tried to kill me. And I'm like, oh, okay, there's no way around that. It's just, it felt like, oh, I wanted to save you, but it didn't feel like I had any chance to really do that. And then I'm like, yeah, I'm just not feeling it. So,
yeah, it's an interesting case where in some ways, I think they know their audience better than anyone, because I think what people really want from a Bethesda game are the tools to create their own fun. And I think the creation engine is the best on the market when it comes to modding. They're very open for that sort of thing. And I'm sure the community will take this game and run with it forever. And from what I understand of New Game Plus, it definitely offers you a ton of options for replayability. It completely changes the experience every time that you go into a New Game Plus. And so I think in terms of longevity, and this audience definitely loves to play Bethesda games for a very, very long time, that's there for them. For those people who want all 1,000 planets, that's going to offer them a lot of content. But as you said, it's just a lot of content. It's not really high quality content. Now, with that said, I did find that on Xbox when I was playing, tweaking the controls really made the combat feel better. I was able to tweak them a little bit, and I did find that it felt really good. And on PC, by default, this is far and away the best feeling Bethesda game. Like, it's not even, I wouldn't even put it in the same realm as other Bethesda games. It genuinely felt like a pretty decent shooter once I had switched over to PC, and I was like, oh, okay, I kind of get the appeal here. Like, I loved raiding ships. And just like in Skyrim, once I found a sort of an activity that I enjoyed, for maybe 10 hours, I was satisfied just stealing ships. For whatever reason, that was like a fun thing for me where, okay, somebody landed on this planet, I'm just going to go and steal their ship. And that building up a collection of all these random ships that I had was enjoyable for me. And it presented a little bit of that role-playing aspect. And out in space, if you take down somebody's engines, then you can board them. And if you take them out, then you can have the ship. So there was that one little mechanic that I enjoyed. But beyond that, I completely agree. There was nothing about the story that hooked me. The characters, I think probably the one who stood out to me the most was Sam Coe, partially because
Elias Tufexis.
Yeah. he's the Deus Ex voice actor. And so I was like, oh, well, I guess I'm a little bit more emotionally attached because of that. And he tells dad jokes and stuff. But
yeah,
beyond that, there wasn't really anything. And I think also it was hurt not only because I had been playing Baldur's Gate, which really is a hard comparison to go back to. Mm-hmm. But they are very different games. So I'm like, okay, cast that aside. The problem was I then started playing for the first time in several years since it launched, Cyberpunk 2077.
Mm.
And the challenge there is those games are both dialogue heavy. You have companions. You're growing relationships. The difference is that in Cyberpunk 2077, when you're having a conversation with somebody, you have control of the camera still. And so no matter how long a conversation is, no matter how boring the dialogue is, not that it was very often in Cyberpunk, but the difference is I can be looking around the scene. I can be doing different things. Like it helps you to maintain focus. In Starfield, the camera is locked to this person's face. And if they move around the environment, it just follows their face. And it's this creepy, as you said, automaton effect that all of a sudden they go from being human to a face, or like not even a face. It's pixels pasted onto a skeleton. Like there's this weird disconnect where it's hard to find the humanity in the characters in a way that I didn't find with either Baldur's Gate or Cyberpunk, which were the two other narrative games I played at the time. And so, yeah, I think there are kind of cool mechanics. I think the ship combat is just okay. I had played Everspace 2 because it was free on Game Pass as well, and the ship combat there blows this out of the water. The dialogue was better in Baldur's Gate and Cyberpunk. The shooting is better in, like, Warhammer Vermintide 2, which is another Game Pass game. Like, I just think everything that's in this game, beyond the modding and the people who are really into the Bethesda-style cozy experience, you can just find better elsewhere. And so that's kind of where I landed.
And to your point, it isn't fair to compare it to other games like BG3 or whatever.
Yeah.
So that's fine. I get that. To me, like, even just on a base level, if you're looking at broader quest design and everything, like,
totally.
You mentioned Sam as a good example. When you first meet him and do like his first quest, he wants you to go to a planet with him. You go there. It's kind of like a saloon type because he's like a cowboy. So it's kind of like a cowboys and aliens sort of whatever. And you get there and there's like a hostage situation at the bank. And then, so your options are negotiate with them, let them kill the hostages, or fight them, really. And those are really, so it's either the bad guys die, the hostages die, or you just, you know, F off, really. And it's really just three outcomes, and they don't really have any impact on anything larger. But even in the context of the quest, it's really just three sort of outcomes that are kind of boring. And that's sort of every quest in that game. That's kind of, like, I saw someone like kind of boiled that down that way, and like, yeah, that's a good point. Like, even if we're not thinking about how BG3 has so many different outcomes and so many different ways of an intertwining quest or whatever, just the quest design is just so rigid like that, where it's all very, this happens this time. It's like ending A, ending B, ending C, and there's not a lot of variety in between. And I'm like, it really just comes to, in my case, oh, I play characters, I like to play characters who have who are good in conversation. So I usually emphasize persuasion and those types of skills. For so sure. For me, it's like, oh, I'm going to negotiate to stop them. But really, that didn't change anything. Like, I didn't feel like I really did anything interesting. And like, it didn't feel like a, that should have been like a tense, like hostage situation sort of thing, like Inside Man or whatever. And I'm like, it's,
there were no stakes.
No, it yeah. just felt boring.
Well, and just so. To quickly jump on that, and Dean, I think this is probably where you coming off of Baldur's Gate also might run into this, is the companions. When in Baldur's Gate, every time you do a mission, if you speak to them, they have some thought on it, right? If they like, they feel very, human's not the right word because they're a bunch of different species, but you know what I mean? Like they have thoughts and feelings races. And they'll, yeah, yeah. They have different races where, Even like a tiefling will feel different about a situation than a drow will based on how you handled that. Whereas in Starfield, sometimes I'll accidentally throw a grenade. It just happens. I'm bad at the game. I don't know. So I'll accidentally throw a grenade and I would like damage my companion. And for that one moment, they're upset with you because they're like, why would you do that? 30 seconds later, they've completely forgotten that's happened. And those sorts of issues happen all the time where a situation would play out, they weren't happy with you, and then you go, you do something they enjoy, and they're back in your good books. Like it's those shortcomings with the characters as well, that a lot of repeated dialogue, a lot of moments where they do something that doesn't really make sense, or like it is the most polished, I guess, in the sense that there aren't a ton of glitches, but I was never immersed in the world. I was always aware that I was playing a game that I knew how to cheat, and it's, I could choose not to do it, but if you know that an AI isn't going to peek around the corner, the temptation is still there to just, okay, one shot peek. Like there's all of those limitations, both with the characters, the story, and the actual combat. And so it fell short in so many areas, and I really want Microsoft to have a win. So I hope this game at least performed well sales-wise. And from what I understand, it did do pretty well, especially on Game Pass for them. A lot of signups and that sort of stuff. I really want them to do well, but I would agree. This, to me, shouldn't even be in the conversation for Game of the Year. Not because I'm not a Bethesda fan. Like, we have enjoyed games in the past. I've played every Bethesda game since, I think, Oblivion. It's just, it feels dated, as you said. And in a year with so many games that are pushing the boundaries of design, especially, it just doesn't even register.
To me, I kept joking, it wasn't even the best RPG with the name Star in its name that came out around that time. That would right. be Sea of Stars, right. that, which actually had a higher Metacritic, which yeah. I was happy to see. So,
just quickly, Chris, I think you might be a kleptomaniac. You seem to want to keep stealing crap from people in these games.
You're not wrong. I mean, I do like stealing hearts as well in Persona. So, yeah, probably onto something.
Just a funny tie back, though, of and then we'll move on. But you saying that a character getting like a companion getting upset with you and then just being like forgetting a second later. There was a moment in BG3 where I did my buddies were like, we should bring Shadowheart with us. And I was just like, no, that's fine. We don't need her. We're like, okay. And we do the quest and Shadowheart comes back and she's like, you went without me? What the hell?
Is this the Gauntlet of Shar?
Yeah, yeah, yeah. And she's like, what the hell? And then she leaves. She's gone. She's never coming back.
I mean, to be fair, for like the 30 hours before that, she kept talking about how that's her one life's mission. I watched that cutscene yesterday. She's literally like, you know, my life is empty and meaningless now because you stole that from me. And I'm like, so. But yeah, that's kind of a cool way of how your companions react to you. Like in some other games, it's really just, if you go light side, you get this companion. If you go dark side, you get this companion and it locks you out of the other one. And that's really it. But in this game, obviously there's no morality system, which is nice, but also just that, yeah, there's so many different characters that you could get, you could miss, that they could leave you, just not even die, but just leave you because they're so utterly heartbroken over what you've done. Like,
totally.
She's just so upset. I laughed. I couldn't. We'll still laugh about it. It's been a while since that happened, and we'll still just laugh about it.
Dean, this is breaking my heart, though, because, one, you killed my favorite character in the game. Alphira, the musician, is my favorite character. And then, in my solo run, Shadowheart was my romance, and you kicked her out of the group. But not, like, what? We are on different levels.
She's my romance too, partly because I just I like her design. I like the voice. She reminds me of Morrigan a bit from
Morrigan vibes for sure. Yeah,
which is cool because another cool gothy witch type. That's my soft spot, I guess. But no, I mean all characters are great.
I think there's so many fun characters in that game that stand out. Even small, little, like you said, like the bartenders or those sorts of things that stand out in a way that never in Starfield did I come across a side character that stuck with me unless their face was glitching out. I think BG3 really has raised the bar in many, many ways for how to build a world that feels real.
So to move on, I do have a question about Phantom Liberty. I assume that's what you went back to Cyberpunk?
So funnily enough, actually, I went back for the 2.0 update because I had played the game back when it launched on PC. So I didn't run into any of the problems that the console versions had.
Lucky you.
I know. I lucked out. I bought a 3070 at launch and got one day one. So I didn't pay the exorbitant prices. I built my first PC and I was like, oh, Cyberpunk. That just came out, launched it. It ran well for me. Sure, I ran into a few bugs, but like the game was in good condition on PC around launch. But the 2.0 update was actually what I went back for. It changes so much. If you have not played Cyberpunk, now is actually the time. People are not exaggerating. Even small things like in Starfield, one of my frustrations is that the game expects you to just pick up everything because you don't know what's worthwhile and what's not. And then you can go and sell it. That was very much the case in Cyberpunk as well. It's a running trend in video games across the board. Like I remember Wolfenstein had the same thing. Anything shiny, pick it up. Anything shiny, pick it up. That is gone now in the 2.0 update with Cyberpunk. So no longer do you need to pick up everything. It's really just weapons. Everything else is on kind of a timer. So you get your grenades back. You get your healing items back. Like they found ways to do
interesting.
All of your skill trees are completely reworked. There's so many new builds and abilities and everything. The quest lines have even been cleaned up. So some of the story stuff has been tightened up in small ways. That's what I went back for. I've done every ending in Cyberpunk except for one now. Over the last few weeks, I've been going through, it's kind of like my break game from Baldur's Gate as I've just played so much of it. I've been blown away.
Are you talking about the new ending that they added with Phantom Liberty or another one besides?
Yeah, this is where it gets interesting is I've only done, so I believe there's like 5 or 6 endings in the base game. And then the new Liberty expansion adds a few new endings. And so what I haven't touched yet is Phantom Liberty. So I will give you guys an update next time because I've done everything in the base game, at least in terms of main character storylines, main story, all of the main side quests. I haven't done everything in the map because it's a huge checklist kind of thing.
Yeah.
But I've done all of the endings except for one. So as soon as I've done the secret Johnny ending in the base game, then I'm going to go into Phantom Liberty. Very, very excited about that because I've just been so impressed with the game overall that I think if people are saying this takes it even further and is even better that I can't wait to see what it has.
Yeah. My only issue is I don't think it should have come out at this time. I feel like this is its big comeback story. It should have had time to breathe because I'm in the same boat. I would have loved to jump into it. I actually really like the base game, warts and all. I think it did have a beating heart, a really strong thematic core at its core. Issues aside, so hearing that all of that's kind of retained obviously but then just kind of enhanced, and then knowing that what CDPR has done with the two expansions for The Witcher 3, which are the best expansions for any game really, and knowing that we're getting this with more Keanu, more Idris, like I'm super excited for it. But knowing it came out at the end of September, I'm like, why are you doing that? Like this should have come out in like January or even December when it's quiet, because like big game in December as far as I'm aware is Avatar, like the Frontiers of Pandora game from Ubisoft. So it's like I feel like it should have, because it's a shame because they put all this work into it and I don't actually see enough people talking about it because I think it's just gotten buried under everything else.
I'm with you.
Especially so close to Starfield and BG3, which are massive RPGs, and then obviously the Xbox version of BG3 still to come later this year, supposedly. So it's a shame because everything you're saying sounds great. You know, we got offered a code. I gave it to my friend Andrew to write about for us because I'm like, I don't have time for this. Like straight up, I'm like, I wish this came out at another time, but I'm like, it's a shame. But everything you're saying sounds awesome. And
you make me want to re-download it. I really did like the game originally. Of course, the bugs were annoying and my game would crash a few times, but I only did one ending because I was like, you know what, they're gonna fix this game, so I'll come back to it, right? And then I just, now it's not a great time for me to come back to it, because
that's exactly it. We all moved on, right? And yeah. And it is hard to find that time to go back. And had I not kind of bounced off of Starfield and then had this open period before Spider-Man 2, like it wouldn't have happened until next year, and who knows what next year is gonna be like. So,
and then for you it's an open period, for me it's a Souls-like period.
That's right. Okay, so I want to ask about this. I have so many questions.
So I barely touched Lies of P because of BG3. I've been so obsessed with it until literally, I think this week has been the first week where I have not touched BG3 at all. I have not touched it at all because I'm like, I want to write about Lords of the Fallen. I'm currently writing about it. I've only been, I think I'm like 15-ish hours in right now. But I'm almost still write about my thoughts so far, just because reviews came up today, and then I'm having a lot of fun with it. But there are some issues, unfortunately. There's the lock-on mechanics aren't as good as Dark Souls games. And I've had like this weird experience where I had a review copy that was missing audio cues, and the longer you played it, it started to crash. Those have been updated out. Now I have audio cues again. They're back. And that problem is gone now. So I'm not gonna really dwell on it on my review because this is pre-launch stuff, but it made like playing it for the first couple hours kind of weird as well. But I'm really liking it so far, and to go to Lies of P, really enjoying what I've done there. I'm only probably 5 to 8 hours in that game because playing two Souls likes are difficult, especially when they're on two different consoles. Because I'm playing Lies of P on Xbox with Game Pass. When I naturally just love to play games on PlayStation, so that's why I'm playing Lords of the Fallen on PlayStation. But that game is also very fun. They have a lot of similarities too. Both Souls-like, both have that Bloodborne-like mechanic where you can gain back some of your health after it's lost. And then also, both don't really, you're not really, Dark Souls has a big shield up, keeping your shield up, bouncing, and then wait for your time to strike. These games don't have that.
Like Bloodborne.
Yeah, they're Lies of P more so, because Lies of P, you don't have a shield at all. Whereas Lords of the Fallen, you can have a shield, but at least as far as I am in the game, they don't really have good physical protection at all so far. So I've just been dual wielding, and you could kind of like block with your two swords together, which is kind of
cool. Oh, that's cool.
Yeah.
Is it like a parry mechanic, or is it more just a block?
It's just a block.
Okay.
Straight up blocking of two swords together. Some of the things are kind of weird, like the backstab mechanic. I still haven't really figured it out in Lords of the Fallen, which is strange because I love backstabbing in the other Souls-like games. Whereas in Lies of P, you'll see when you can backstab. There's like a little symbol will show
icon.
Up. Yeah, a little icon will show up, and then it's like, oh, perfect, I can backstab now. And so backstabbing in that game is really fun and easy, but Lords of the Fallen, it's not. I haven't really figured it out yet. There is a parry mechanic in Lords of the Fallen as well, but the timing is very hard to get, where whenever I get it, I'm mostly just like, oh, sick, like shocked. I'm not trying to get it, I'm just trying to block, and then
right.
I manage to parry. But yeah, two very Soulsies games that I'm having fun with, playing them back to back before I get absorbed by Spider-Man.
Okay, so I have a couple questions for you, just as somebody else who has enjoyed Souls games recently. I was a very late comer to the genre. I would say Bloodborne was the first one that really hit for me. Yeah. But then I still couldn't quite get into the Souls games.
Okay.
Just because of the pacing, and I wasn't as interested in the world as Bloodborne. But then Elden Ring really sucked me in. Like, that was a game that blew me away in many, many ways. So with Lies of P and Lords of the Fallen, those are Souls-likes. So they borrow a lot of mechanics, but both visually and story-wise, they seem very far apart from one another. So Lies of P feels steampunk. And then Lords of the Fallen is like dark fantasy, would you say?
Mm-hmm.
So how are you finding the storytelling? Because From Software is very ambiguous with how they kind of go about their storytelling. I would say unless you're really looking for it and paying attention, it can be hard to track kind of what the main through line is. How do you find it in Lies of P specifically? That one seemed very narrative heavy by comparison.
Vati video.
Yeah. Yeah, a lot of Vati video for me. Lies of P, because I'm not super far in, the story is... There is a story there. There is definitely one there. You don't have to read it through all the items. I think some of the items do have little glimpses of it, I think. But there is definitely some story there. You save Geppetto. He's being attacked by the mad donkey, and you save him, and then you go through. You're a puppet. You're the whole purpose of the... There are four rules puppets have to go abide by. One of them is not killing humans, and that's seemed to have failed, and you don't know why yet, or I don't know why yet, but one of them is you puppets can't lie, which is why you're different, where you can lie. So the safe area in the game, the one safe area in the game, you have to lie to get in there.
Right.
And then there's another part where a lady is like, my child is dead. My child is missing. Can you help me find my child? And you find the child, and it's like a puppet baby. It's not a real baby. And you go back to her, and she's like, "Oh, this is my baby, beautiful." And I'm like, "Yeah, sure, why not?" But you can lie and say it is beautiful, and you can tell her the truth and say it's a puppet. But no, I chose to lie. I think my point in the game is I'm going to just keep lying is my role, because I want to be more human like.
So have you noticed any kind of implications for that? Have you been punished for lying?
Okay. I haven't noticed it yet. Not as far as I am. I think, from my understanding, there's quite a few different endings.
Oh, cool. Okay.
So I'm pretty sure that the lying leads to some endings.
Mm-hmm.
There's also the post-credit scene is wild.
Really?
I was talking about it with Dean. I don't know if you're going to play it, or I won't spoil it, but... if you're interested, look it up. Okay. It sets up what the next game could be.
Totally.
And it's I was like, whoa, okay.
I really enjoy how fairy tale-y it is. You have Jiminy Cricket with you, who like he's the one who like tells you things that like, oh, you don't go or you can't go there, or tell you about this part of the world, or
it's like your Zelda companion.
Yeah, like Navi, or, exactly. Cool. Hey, listen. No. And there's like different types of puppets too, as well. Like one was a crazy clown looking guy. There was another one who was like a police, looking one so far. And you just like they seem to have done a good job. It's not perfect, I wouldn't say. I think that I don't know. There's no major flaws, but it's not perfect so far.
When I played the demo for Lies of P, and one of the things that I found was that I was having a lot more difficulty than I was with an Elden Ring or a Bloodborne initially, because the dodge roll was very short at that time. Is that they had said they tweaked it for full release? Have you found that the difficulty is more intense or anything like that? How does it kind of compare in terms of the challenge present?
So I did the demo as well. Mm-hmm. And it took me a few hours to do the demo. When I played it, maybe 2 or 3 hours. But when I played it, the demo is just the first beginning part of the game.
It's right.
Like the exact same. But doing it now was a lot easier, and it could be just because I know where to go because I did the demo, but it felt a lot easier. I think the dodge is better, and the mechanics do seem smoother than the demo did as well. I also know in that game you level up your health, level it up first.
Okay, good tip.
Yeah, it's very helpful having a bigger vitality in that game, more than any other Souls-like I've played. Or maybe my Souls-like experiences would have been easier if I did that as well.
Oh, that's cool. That's cool. I've been attracted to Liza P because of the style. Like, they definitely settled on a vision for that game and committed to it, and it seems like they pulled it off. And it's cool too because it comes from a Korean developer, and I don't know of a lot of Korean games. Mm-hmm. At least I didn't think so. But Korea's kind of having a moment right now between this Dave the Diver. They have, I keep forgetting the name of it. They have that one really cool looking, almost like Devil May Cry style action sword game that PlayStation has as an exclusive looks really cool. I know, it's on the tip of my tongue. It starts with an S, I think. That's okay. We'll think of it. We know what we're talking about.
Yeah. Exactly
what you're talking Korean about. Development scene is definitely coming up, just like the Chinese game development scene. Like PlayStation made a big investment into that market, gave a lot of kind of money to the developers there, and we're seeing that with the other game. It was another almost Bloodborne-esque, but looks more action game that they showed off at their last PlayStation showcase.
Can't remember that one's called either, but it's...
It has zero in the title, I think, after it. But yeah, basically, there are all these really cool experiences coming out of markets that haven't traditionally put out AAA blockbuster titles, and the output has been incredible. So I'm really excited for those. Quickly on Lords of the Fallen, though, you played Lies of P, Lords of the Fallen, same genre, very different approaches. What is the appeal of Lords of the Fallen for maybe somebody like me who hasn't experienced the first game? What's the sell for it?
So I didn't play the first game, really. I tried it and was like, this isn't fun. Like, I just straight up maybe played an hour of it and was like, I'm not having fun. It's too clunky. It's slow. You can't design the character, or at least as far as you could. You couldn't. It wasn't your own character. There's three options. From what I remember, and it just wasn't as. Well, it wasn't what I wanted, especially after just playing Bloodborne. Bloodborne was my first Souls-like, so then I started with that, and then I was like, "Well, let me go back and try different ones." And I was like, "I don't like Lords of the Fallen." This one is super fun. I love what I've been enjoying a lot is the exploration. I'm really enjoying for those who don't know, there's two worlds on top of each other. One is called Axiom. That's the main world, the world of the living, where you go in. It's just like a normal Dark Souls game, whatever, Axiom. But if you die, you come back to life like Sekiro, but you come back to life in the underworld called Umbral. Umbral has, it looks creepier. There's like at some points it was very, what's that game called? The walking simulator game.
Death Stranding?
Yeah, very Death Stranding. There's just dead things just hanging. There's just dead
things. I wish that was a walking simulator.
There's just like dead things hanging around. There's like, it's creepier, but it opens up new ways to explore. Whereas in Axiom, you'll see a lake. But in Umbral, there's no water. Water does not exist. So that lake is just now somewhere you can explore now, and you can go under. You can find out. There's also an axia, and sometimes you'll just be like, "Where am I supposed to go?" And this has happened a few times where I'm kind of lost more than I have been in previous Souls-likes. But it's like, oh yeah, it must be time for me to go into Umbral. Yeah, and then you go. You can spend the life to do it, or you can just fight and die. When you're in Umbral, there's different passageways, there's different you'll find ladders that weren't there before because they're made out of like someone's spine. There's different enemies, and the longer you're in Umbral, the more in this game souls are called vigor. More vigor you'll get because there's a multiplier. So you'll end up getting more, but then the longer you're in there, the creepier things that come out. There was one point where I was just like, oh, this area is not easy. This area is not hard. Let me just chill. And then like I'm in Umbral, and then these red glowing things just start coming at me, and I just literally got scared and went back to the bonfire and got out of there. Cause I was like, I don't want to lose my souls, but these things are scary. What's also cool is that you can just hold a lamp up, and the lamp will show you into Umbral, so you don't always have to die. So if you do know there's a bridge there, You can just raise your lamp and the bridge will appear just in that area. But
that's super cool.
That is very cool. But things, it's because you can see into Umbral, things can see into see you as well. So if you keep it up too long, something can attack you and bring you into Umbral, which is cool. A little annoying sometimes, but
sure.
Yeah,
this is cool. One of those mechanics though that I haven't really seen done
exactly
before. Like it does sound very, very original.
Yeah, that's what I love about it. That's what I love about it more than, like, the combat is good and quick, but the lock-on mechanic, I think I mentioned it, isn't great. So sometimes you're behind the character enemies. And Axiom itself, at least where I've been, it's like the lighting or the color textures, the colors feel weird. It's like a little, it's kind of hard to, or there's a lot of like smoke and dust in the air and whatever. So it's hard to
read the environment sometimes.
Yeah, exactly. Okay. Whereas when you're in Umbral, it's this dark, creepy world, but you can perfectly see everything. It's because there's nothing alive is there, right?
Right. How have you found the performance? Just because I know reviews came out today and we were talking about this a little bit before the podcast, like they're all over the place. There's some fours, there's some eights. Yeah. They're kind of ranging.
I think it really depends on when that person wrote the review.
Okay.
Playing it last night, and there was a few updates that came out yesterday for PS5. It was a lot smoother than I had been playing it before. And this is one of the first games where I don't really ever have performance mode on. I usually always have the picture quality to look nicer. I like when things look really nice. But I had to switch it to performance mode because I was having more stuttering issues, and that did help a lot. But it made it not look as nice, which is a little annoying.
And did you find that, like, sometimes a performance mode to a quality mode, it's just a slight drop in resolution, or maybe they turn off some of the extra effects like God rays or whatever it is, right? What was the noticeable change in that quality?
It's a resolution thing. Okay. There's a drop in resolution, yeah.
Gotcha.
But yeah, it's a really fun game. I think I'm having more fun playing Lords of the Fallen more than Lies of P.
Interesting.
Because I'm more of a dark fantasy. I love Dark Souls 3. That's one of my favorite games as well. I love like different spells you get. I love magic. I love magic so much. and there's cool different spells that you couldn't get in that you've never type of seen in Dark Souls games. The magic is cool. Works differently as well. So I really do enjoy it so far. I feel like it needed a little bit more time in the oven.
Should have given it more time in the oven. Again, just the craziest month. We have Spider-Man 2 literally, what is it, next week?
Next week.
Next Friday?
And
Mario Wonder, same day.
Mario Wonder, Alan Wake 2, like this
Sonic.
It's an impossible period to come out. Like Lords of the Fallen seems cool. There's no chance I'm playing it this year. There's no chance.
Yeah, for me it was a highlight because I'm just a Souls fan and I am really enjoying it. And I'm happy I'm doing it, but I'm so excited for Spider-Man. So I better finish this game before next Friday. Brad, can you lead us into some Spider-Man? Please tell Brad has already platinum this game. Just to let everyone know.
I knew you got the code, but dang. Yeah.
There was one trophy that I was stuck on because I was overthinking it and I had to reach out to someone that I know was playing it. And I actually got the platinum later than I should have because I was sitting at 98% of the trophies for like Thanksgiving weekend. But I finally got it on Monday on Thanksgiving. So thankfully.
That's something to be
thankful
I
love
for.
It. Yes, I love it. I think it's a smart and natural evolution from the last two games. I think my biggest thing was Insomniac is a great studio, and they obviously proved themselves with the last two Spider-Man. However, being a Spider-Man fan, I have seen time and time again how Spider-Man stories have been ruined by overstuffing them with too many characters, too many story side plots, etc., etc. Spider-Man 3 obviously was the first example of that. And I think that movie's still legitimately solid. Raimi did the best he could given everything, but there was too many villains. Amazing Spider-Man 2 was the worst example of that. So many things going on. Even something like No Way Home got pretty messy at times with all the things going on, even though I really like that movie.
Yeah,
but
that's true.
So point being, having a game where two Spider-Man are the co-leads, mm-hmm. we've never had before. Like Shattered Dimensions, shout out to Beenox and Quebec City, had four playable Spider-Man, but the structure was very weird because they all had their own separate levels, and then yeah. they never really came together. It was just, even the final boss fight, they weren't fighting together. They were fighting Mysterio individually in their own respective worlds.
Yeah,
so
that's right.
We've never really had a game, and even something like Spider-Verse, the new Spider-Verse movie, Gwen is a large supporting character. You could argue she's the co-lead with Miles, but it's still Miles' movie.
Right?
That's going to be his trilogy. She has a big role in it. So, and obviously No Way Home has three Spider-Man, but Tom Holland is the lead. So anyways, my point being is we've never really had something that, especially a video game, you know, 20, 30 hour video game that juggles two characters. So I was a little worried. I'm like, how are they going to do that? Is it going to feel like more of Peter's story and Miles as a side character sort of thing? Because that obviously is very easy to imagine. But no, they handled it so well. The ways that they balance it, every character, each character gets meaningful things to do in the story. You know, from a gameplay perspective, Miles has all his Venom powers, and they've, you know, expanded on some of those as well. And then obviously Peter has the symbiote. So it doesn't feel like one is necessarily more powerful than the other. They just have different sort of versatilities. But even like from a larger thing, and this is kind of what I'm going to get into my review, is that every character is served very well by this story. Like what I love is that everyone is kind of given a chance to shine, whether it's Mary Jane, whether it's Kraven, whether it's Harry. This is maybe my favorite take on Harry that we've ever gotten.
Wow.
Outside of the comics. It's very much in the spirit of Amazing Spider-Man 2, where the whole idea that, oh, Harry's sick and he's kind of coming back into Peter's life and he needs help. That's sort of the core story behind Harry in this game. But obviously a testament to the strength of video games is, unlike a 2-hour movie that Sony had setting up 500 other movies, this is a 20, 30 hour game. So they can really explore Peter and Harry's relationship before obviously things hit the fan. And I like the fact that you don't actually get the symbiote until several hours in. Like when I did preview event, when I did the preview event, they made it sound, because we had already had the symbiote at that point, they made it sound like that was really like only like 2 or 3 hours into the game. But no, it was several hours. So you spend a lot of time with Harry, a lot of time with, they've confirmed it. So there's a whole section with Peter, Harry, and Mary Jane at Coney Island. And it reminded me in the best possible way of The Last of Us Part 2, when you're in the museum with Ellie, this very heartfelt, touching sort of relationship between these characters and them hanging out and playing games and everything. And you really feel that relationship with Harry. So when things ultimately do, you know, put them on opposite ends, because it's not a spoiler to say the trailers heavily suggest Harry is Venom. So that's all I'm going to say. They confirmed it wasn't Eddie Brock. So obviously there's some antagonism that's going to go on between them, but it feels meaningful and earned. The way Miles plays into the story, what I really love is that everyone has, like, there are side quests that, so there's main story quests where you play as one, you play as the other, and then somewhere you're switching between the two mid side quests, like we saw in that set piece from the State of Play, which is really good. But then there's side quests that are specific to each character, and then there are side quests that either of them can do, which is really cool because there's, fundamentally, they play out the same. You know, it's not like a BG3 style game where there's going to be 100 different outcomes.
Yeah,
that's not that kind of game. But there's a lot of cool different dialogue depending on which character you use. And I kind of liked that. I don't know if either of you did the side quest in the first game and did the one with the old guy and the pigeon.
Oh yeah, yeah, yeah. You're just talking about the sky.
Even that was kind of like a silly, like kind of filler quest. They bring that guy back, and there's such an emotional beat to that this time around, and you can do that quest with either Peter or Miles.
Oh, cool.
And I did it with Miles because I'm like, I was kind of making those decisions where it's like I could play as Peter, who's the more experienced Spider-Man, and he obviously has a bit of a relationship with this older guy, or I could play as the fresh-faced teen who's kind of still new at this, and that's kind of an interesting dynamic, him talking to this older man who's, you know, done a bunch of things in his life. So, and then you get a lot of interesting dialogue with that. So I thought that was really cool. But also just that, like I said, the way they balance them, like Peter's story is very much about Harry and MJ, and Miles is very much about Mr. Negative from the first game. The arc that he goes on through that is really compelling. Everything with his mother is just super touching. There's a whole side quest Because the one thing that Miles Morales did really well over the video game, Miles Morales did very well over the 2018 game, was the side quests felt very improved and very rooted in a sense of community. Like you really felt like Miles was a hero for Harlem specifically.
Yeah.
And so they really doubled down on that here. Like they bring back Haley from which was such a nice character. She has such she has a much bigger role in this, which is really nice. She's a really got a very endearing relationship with Miles. For context, she's deaf, which is cool. And then Miles like does sign language with her, which is really awesome. So they bring her back, but also just like there's a side quest chain where there's a side quest chain where Miles is helping his mother recover stolen equipment from a museum because Miles is wants to study to do music. So you kind of learn more about his passion for music, and they also kind of flesh out his relationship with his mother because they're obviously both dealing with the loss of the dad from the last game. And then that really pays off in like a really cool, like it's like that whole side quest is like kind of a tribute to like the pioneering African-American musicians, which is really cool. Like I won't spoil how they get into that, but the payoff to that whole side quest is like, oh, it's not even just a nice thing between Miles and his mom, but it's like it's celebrating the whole New York community and like all these like cool jazz musicians and everything. I'm like, so there's just so many cool little things like that where like everyone kind of feeding into that larger theme of like everyone can be a hero. Like you don't have to be a superhero, you don't have to have a symbiote, you know, you can everyone, whether you're Aunt May or a jazz musician or Rio, Miles's mother. So I loved it. And I didn't even really touch on the gameplay, just the web wings are so cool.
Oh, I'm like, so excited about that.
I can't wait to fly around.
That's exactly. I love any game like Just Cause 3 where you get a jetpack and stuff is just the best.
It's one of those things where, again, there's a little bit of a worry there. I'm hesitant to even use the word worry, but just that, you know, the core swinging is so good. Like, why would you mess with that?
Yeah.
But they've done such a great way in implementing it into the swinging where it just feels like a natural extension of it, where it's not, you're still fundamentally going to be swinging most of the time. But I love the moments where, because in other games, you know, if you're swinging and there's not really any building around, you're kind of stuck in the middle of the air. You can try to do like a web zip or whatever, but generally you're just going to kind of fall and you kind of lose all momentum that way. But with the web wings, you can just launch off into an area where there's not a lot of tall buildings and then web wing until you get to another one. They have a lot of like strategically placed air currents, which is a very video gamey sort of thing, but it's very useful for a traversal where it's either there's some that shoot upwards to give you a lot more verticality and then others that are horizontal just to kind of zip you. Those are particularly handy if you're like crossing bridges and everything. Especially because one of the new neighborhoods that they added in this is Queens, which is Peter's hometown. So there's a lot of very small houses, low houses. So there's not a lot of places to swing from that. So in that sense, it's really cool to just kind of web glide or use the wing glide over Peter's neighborhood, which is really cool.
I've been to New York, I think, 5 or 6 times in the last year. So I'm super excited. Yeah. Now that I feel like I really know the city a lot more, I'm really excited to really explore it all. Peter seems like a jerk, though. Like, he seems like in the trailers, he's kind of...
So what I love about this game, and it's what the Insomniac team does so well with the narrative perspective, they using, again, because games just have the natural ability when done right to tell a deeper story than a movie can. And so, first of all, Peter's darker side is contextualized with, he literally just lost his aunt, the only person in his only family left in the world. And then his best friend, His only friend, really, right? Because outside of Mary Jane, his only friend, Miles is like his younger brother, I guess you could
say.
He's
a mentee, though. Yeah.
You know, Harry is his lifelong friend, and he comes back into his life, and he's finding out that he's dying, right? So his whole quest is to save Harry. So that's what I like about it, that even when he's wearing the symbiote and there's darker scenes with him, everything is rooted in him trying to save Harry. So it adds a weight to that symbiote arc.
It makes sense.
Some other times in those sorts of stories, they don't necessarily justify why he's as bad as he is. It's just, it's kind of the symbiote. But here it's like, he's grieving his aunt and he's desperate to save the only other family he has, really, other than Mary Jane and Miles.
A little bit about that, because Spider-Man has been around for decades, and we've seen so many iterations of kind of the same stories. It's why the Tom Holland movies finally didn't repeat the story of Uncle Ben dying. You know, it's that sort of stuff that we hear so often.
They didn't even mention him.
Right, right, exactly. It's one of those things where when we saw in the gameplay snip, like this little vertical slice they showed at the PlayStation Showcase, and he's Venom, I went, oh no, are they repeating the same story again that we're so familiar with? Even in the first game, I think it was an awesome iteration of Doc Ock, but Dr. Octopus, we're all very familiar with what that journey is. Do you feel that they subverted a few of those expectations here, or are we following the same beat by beat version of Venom and Kraven and all of these others that we've seen before?
No, I think they definitely, I will say, one of my few criticisms is I don't think Kraven is as cool as he could be.
Okay.
I think that's always a villain who has a lot of potential but isn't used that well. And I think in this case, just the way the story's told, he has a lot of a background role a lot of the time because he's kind of like in the shadows manipulating a lot of things. Like the whole reason the lizard is around is because that Kraven orchestrated that. The whole reason Mr. Negative escaped is because Kraven escaped him or broke him out. So
he wants
these aren't spoilers.
The best of the best, right? Like these were all shown names. A Black Cat was in there as well. And
And you can do some side quests to learn a bit more about Kraven's family because there's a whole backstory to that, including the Chameleon being his brother in the comics.
Cool. Cool.
I'm not saying anything more about that in the game. Play it to find out. But there, you can learn a bit more about his family. But I will say I don't think they do anything particularly interesting with Kraven, but I do think the symbiote story is among the better takes that we've seen on it because, again, they have the longer form ability to explore it through gameplay, through side quests, through all that sort of thing. And also just the fact that Miles is in the picture. That's something that we haven't really seen a lot of the other times with the symbiote story. Miles isn't there because Miles is a recent character, right? He's only introduced maybe like 10 years ago. So any popular iteration of the symbiote story, Miles just wasn't a part of it. So seeing how, you know, this younger kid who looks up to Peter is going to play into that, right, is important. And I also think, to their credit, there have been a lot of, obviously, Peter, Mary Jane stories over the years. And part of the problem with Marvel editorial is they're always afraid to keep them together because they think the only way Peter can be relatable is if he's single, which I think is kind of weird.
Yeah.
Because as if relatability is confined to that and, you know, not just being married and having marital issues, right?
Sure.
But what I like about this game is they doubled, because the first game is very much will they, won't they sort of thing. Obviously they get together, but they were on a break basically.
Yep.
In the first game. But in this game they're fully together. They're kind of weighing in whether she's gonna move in with him because he's at he has Aunt May's house now, which is another thing he's gotta deal with. The mortgage issues with that.
Yeah.
Selling pizza.
Stuff like
relatable.
That is very
relatable.
Yeah, stuff like that is very human and relatable, but also just they get surprisingly into like the intricacies of the Peter and Mary Jane relationship, and the payoff to that is really impressive. And I will say another thing that video games can do that other stories can't is they can play with perspective in an interesting way. So, you know, seeing Peter in the symbiote as other characters, right? Like seeing him as Miles or seeing him as other people, you know, that makes him scarier, right? Yeah. Like, frankly, like, you know, it's one thing to see him in Spider-Man 3, you know, dancing in the jazz club and then hitting Mary Jane. Like,
Dean, he's dancing along.
That's still fundamentally from Peter's perspective. But what do you see when Peter starts to really become this sort of monster in the suit? What does that look like when regular people are looking at him? And if you're playing as those sorts of people or just even seeing it from that perspective, like video games can kind of jump around like that. In a more larger scale than other medium sort of can. So I think that's kind of interesting.
I think one of the
Venom is introduced, I mean, you have Candyman voicing him, Tony Todd. That is the best casting maybe ever for Venom. Like, come on. Like, and one thing I will say, which is really cool, is even before Venom fully is introduced, like Venom proper, as the symbiote starts to take over Peter, you hear Tony Todd's voice here and there kind of feeding in, which is really cool. So there's lots of big things and small things like that that really make this a really interesting story.
I'm so excited.
I know. We're counting down the days at this point. Totally. I'm very jealous that you have platinumed it already. Last question for you, because you kind of touched on it early. There are a lot of villains in this experience. We already know that there's a lot confirmed. If you had to choose a favorite to look out for people who haven't experienced it yet, who should people keep their eye on as kind of a standout villain for you?
I mean, just Venom, I guess, like, and by extension, Harry, just because that's such a compelling story. I think it, in the same way that Doc Ock, that they kind of humanize that relationship with Peter before he becomes evil. And then same thing in the Miles Morales game, where they take the Tinkerer, who's like a C-list character, and make do a complete 180 with her and make her like relevant to Miles' story.
Yeah,
just the way they do with what they do with Harry. Because there's times, like, I love the Raimi movies. I don't particularly think they did a good job of making Harry and Peter feel like friends. Like, I never really bought that Tobey Maguire and James Franco would ever be friends. You know, like, I didn't. So some of that stuff didn't hit as hard as it probably could have. But this game, just they recast the actor who played him, Harry, from the first game, because he was in like the side quest where you would do stuff like science and stuff, and Harry would be like, you'd hear his voice. So it's a different voice, but. It was a very minor role, so the new guy's good, and there's a lot of, they kind of play, they reveal a lot of stuff that happened with them in the past as well.
Cool.
So you kind of get into their friendship there, so I really like that. And just also, again, to the point of the side quests are overall to the quality of, like, Miles Morales again, so there's a lot of surprise villains in those too, I will say, which is fun. And also the collectibles, which this time around are spider bots, not backpacks like the first game. And the spider bots are all from across the Spider-Verse.
Love it.
And not the movie, but what I mean is that a Spider-Verse, there's like a Spider-Man 2099 cool. bot, there's like a Miles Morales bot, there's like a Penny Parker bot, and that's all I'll say. There's a cool payoff to that, and that's all I'll say.
All right, so if nice that we got Goatee number 3 coming out next week. That's great. Awesome.
So many options. All right, guys, this has been a long podcast. I wish we could talk more about this stuff. I mean, we can go back. We could have had a whole podcast just about BG3, just sure. about Starfield, just about My Souls Likes, just about all of this stuff, right? So there's a lot to talk about. But, I mean, we'll do another one, hopefully a lot sooner. My bad, guys, it's been super busy with all the Pixel stuff, but that is it, everyone. Thanks for listening to the Syrup Arcade Cast. Where can people find you at, Brad?
Twitter, I'm not calling it X, Brad Shankar, BRADSHANKAR. Same thing on Instagram and on mobilesyrup.com.
And by the time this podcast is out, Brad's review of Spider-Man will also be out, so please take a look at it. Right, Brad? Am I right? Yeah. Okay,
yes.
And you can find me on Twitter at The Daily Dean, and on Instagram and Threads at My Daily Dose, and of course on mobilesyrup.com, where I have written an article about Lords of the Fallen. And if you're into tech stuff, I just had some Pixel 8 Pro review come out as well. And Chris, people can't find you anywhere still.
I don't exist. I am the AI of the Syrup Cast. So
if you want to find Chris, you can find him on Spotify, where his name is Chris Brown. And actually,
don't give him the money.
Yeah, my bad, guys. Don't do it. But and as always, you can find all of our content on mobilesyrup.com, and also follow us on Twitter and Instagram at mobilesyrup.
Hey, it's Danny Pellegrino from Everything Iconic. Ready to upgrade your style game without blowing your budget? Check out Quince. They've got all the good stuff, shirts and polos, activewear and fine leather goods, all at 50 to 80% less than other high-end brands. And the best part? They're all about safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get that luxury vibe without the luxury price tag. Hit up quince.com/upgrade for free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. That's quince.com/upgrade.